things over to you.
Sure. I just want to thank everybody for being here. This cyber seminar is sponsored by SPRINT, the Suicide Prevention Research Impact Network. And I'm going to turn things right over to Dr. Goodman, who will introduce our fabulous speaker. Thanks.
And Marianne, you are muted.
Okay, great. Let's try that again. Thanks, Steve. I'm excited to introduce Panos Roussos. He is at the James J. Peters VA Medical Center. He's the director of the Center for Precision Medicine and Translational Therapeutics, an investigator at R-MIREC Vision 2. MIREC stands for Mental Illness Research, Education, and Clinical Centers. He's also at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. He's the director for their Center of Disease Neurogenomics and an endowed professor of translational psychiatry, professor of psychiatry and genetics and genomic sciences. We're very proud. He's had a recent cover article of Science, on the cover of Science in May 2024, and another publication coming out in Nature Genetics. We could go on and on talking about his accolades, but I'm going to turn it over to Panos.
Great. Thanks so much, Marianne, and thanks so much for the invitation. Can you just confirm you can hear me?
Yes, we can.
Fantastic. All right. So it's a great pleasure to be here today. So I'm going to give today kind of an overview of how we're approaching very difficult, complex phenotypes in terms of heritability. And then I'm going to end up with a little bit more specific example of how we have been actually approaching the suicidal behavior based on the pilot SPRINT mechanism that we actually got funded a few months ago. So I'm just going to start and saying that I have nothing, no disclosures. And as I start my talk, I would like first to acknowledge the individual that they have contributed lots of the results, especially the one that they're not published yet. And I will start with Sana. He's a very talented graduate student in my lab and also working with under the supervision of Georges Voltakis. And he has been working a lot with the MVP and trying to integrate lots of the human brainomics data within the MVP space. Georges is an associate professor, and he's also associate director for the center we have within the VA, and he's also one of the team leaders within the Center for Disease Neurogenomics. And then David is also an assistant professor within both centers, and he's an expert in using AI to really mine very difficult and complex data, such as the phenotypic data we have within the MVP. And then on the other side, we have many different faculty within Sinai and within the Center for Disease Neurogenomics that they have made significant contribution in many of the omics data I'm going to show you today coming from the human brain. So John Fullard, he's an assistant professor, and he's in charge of the wet lab and single cell efforts within our center. Gabriel Hoffman, he's an associate professor, and he's developing statistical tools and approaches to really analyze those very complex experiment and data. And then Yaro is also an assistant professor leading the bioinformatic pre-processing group. And then Don Hun Lee is also assistant professor with expertise on AI and single cell biology. And with that, I will just give a very quick introduction about why studying suicide is very important. I'm pretty sure that within this group, I don't really need to tell you why this is important, but just very briefly to mention that, as you know very well, suicide is the second leading cause of death in the adolescent and early adulthood in the US, and it's actually the fourth globally. And approximately about almost close to 1 million every year, they actually lose their life because of suicide. What is really very concerning is that since 2001, the suicide rates have increased almost by 30%. And just in 2020, there were about 12 million individuals that they experienced suicidal ideation. And out of those, about 10% they tried to attempt suicide. And what is really sad is about 46,000, they were actually successful to complete suicide. Now, within the VA, this is even more challenging and much more kind of concerning, because when you look at the suicide rate for veterans, this is about 1.5 times higher than what we actually observe in the general population. This is, seems to be affecting even more veteran women, which compared to the non-veteran, there's about a 2.5 times higher suicide rate. And what is really concerning also, compared to early 2000 up to 2019, there has been about 60% increase in the suicide rate. And this is a pretty much around 2 to 2.5 times higher increase compared to what we see actually in the civilians. So this is really a very significant issue. And of course, NIMH and the VA and many other organizations, they have been putting lots of effort and really try to identify new ways that we can actually prevent this suicidal behavior. Now, one thing about the suicide is that suicide, usually there's also comorbid psychiatric diagnosis in about 70 to 90% of the cases. The one that is the most prevalent is the major depression, but also involves many other disorders, including some of the diseases that are more prevalent in veterans, including PTSD, substance use disorder, alcohol use disorder, as well as schizophrenia, bipolar, and many other disorders. So that indicates that suicidal behavior is a very complex phenotype, and there's many other comorbidities that we need to consider as we're thinking about the biology of suicidal behavior. Now, even though about 70 to 90% of the people who attempt suicide, there was a psychiatric diagnosis, there have been some studies that estimate heritability, and it was found that between 20 to 55% from the twin studies suggested that the genetic base of suicidality is actually different and separate of what we actually see from the underlying psychiatric disorders. And since the suicidal is a behavior that there is some kind of established heritability, previous studies and genetic studies that have tried to actually identify those genetic risk factors that they actually associated with the suicidal behavior. And this is the very common design that has been used previously, the genome-wide association studies. And according to those studies, the idea is that you need to have a large population of cases with suicidal behavior versus controls. And then you pretty much scan the whole genome and try to identify genetic regions that they are having a statistical association for the phenotype of interest, which in this case is suicidal behavior. So there has been lots of ongoing efforts, and really the community has been growing dramatically in order to be able to bring data and resources together. And the most recent study that was published last year was able to put together 22 different cohorts. That increased the number of suicide attempt cases to about 44,000. And then as comparison, there's about more than 900,000 individuals that they're matched based on the ancestry that we use as a controls to be able to do this analysis. And after this analysis, 12 loci, which I'm going to show you in the next slide, we're able to reach what we call genome-wide significant level. So this is a typical kind of Manhattan plot that we're getting from the GWAS studies. And as you can see here on the x-axis, we have different positions across the 22 chromosomes. And you can see that each dot represents the statistical association of a single nucleotide variant and the level of association with the phenotype of interest. In this case, with suicide attempt versus controls. And anything that passed multiple testing corrections, which we have already defined at the p-value of 5 at 10 minus 8, and you can see here with red line, this is a statistical significant association. And we say that those specific regions, they're actually associated with suicidal behavior. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that usually when you do this analysis, you get a statistical association for a genetic variant. And many times we give annotation for specific genes, but this is only because based on the proximity and how that genetic variant might be sitting or laying very closely with some very specific genes. But there's not really very direct connection to make sure that this variant and the genes are directly linked. And of course, this is a very significant progress, and it takes a huge amount of effort and lots of individuals and many patients to really try to put all this information together. And as we start getting those very kind of expanded GWAS, of course, what you want to do is when you have this population scale analysis that you're looking at the DNA variation and association with the suicidal behavior, the goal, of course, is to be able to either do target prioritization and come up with new mechanisms and new targets that you can develop now, new drugs and new treatments, or use all this kind of genetic heritability and other molecular markers as part of many other phenotypes that you might be collecting from those individuals, either from clinical data, wearable devices, imaging data, other omics, and really to be able to put that in a context that you can actually promote the precision medicine approach. However, doing all these GWAS studies and really going to the end product, which is target prioritization and precision psychiatry, is not very easy. And it has been very, very challenging, not only for suicide, but for many of those complex disorders that we actually study. And the reason is the following. So first of all, when you see those statistical associations from the GWAS, their effect size is really, really small. And I'm showing you here an example where we actually use a GWAS coming from schizophrenia. And keep in mind the GWAS for schizophrenia, because there's more sample size and there's more higher kind of effect sizes, we have a much more powerful GWAS. But even with this very powerful GWAS, when we aggregate all the genome-wide significant loci to a single score per individual, and we call this polygenic risk score analysis, then we can see that when we go actually and try to see how well we do to separate cases with schizophrenia versus controls, we definitely see a strong and positive effect that we separate the cases, which is in red, compared to the blue. But at the same time, we see that there's a very dramatic and significant overlap. So that alone, even using the whole polygenic risk score, is not going to be alone to tell us who has more likelihood to develop schizophrenia or, in this case, suicidal behavior. And this is because many of those variants, they really explain a very small effect size. The second thing is when we try to do target prioritization and we look at those specific associations, this is the kind of signal we get when we zoom in a very specific locus. So here I'm looking at a very specific position within chromosome 10. I'm looking in a very limited window, and this is my genome-wide significant threshold. And then every genetic variant above this line, they're significant. Now, one thing you're going to appreciate is that I have at least 100 significant loci, right? I mean, there's so many different significant SNPs here, and it's really very difficult to pinpoint which one is the credible one. It's very difficult to know if there's only one or there's more. And what really matters in terms of mechanistic exploration and downstream drug development, I would like to know, is this association has to do something with this gene, or some other genes? So that's very important things that from the GWAS, we don't get that complete information. And we need to do many more additional steps as part of what we call fine mapping analysis to really try to identify the variants and the genes. So, having that kind of GWAS association, where do you want to go next? And again, there's many different directions. I will show you here how we approach those specific kind of challenges within our center. So when you do the GWAS, you have for different loci and for different genomic regions, you have a statistical association for many variants that there is the association with the phenotype of interest. So the first thing you would like to do is you would like to nominate out of all those genetic variants, you would like to find the few ones that they're more likely to be what we call the credible causal variants. Then we would like to identify the specific genes and the proteins that seems to be mediating that specific association. Then we would like to understand the mechanism. Is it something that has to do with change, let's say, in the gene expression, in the protein expression? Is it something that has to do with the splicing of the RNA or some other kind of post-transcriptional modification markers? Then we, of course, would like to understand which specific tissue and which specific cell type this effect seems to be mostly mediated. Then we would like to understand more about the whole genome and how those regulatory mechanisms might be affected. And ideally, when we have multiple different of those loci aggregated to different genes, we can actually organize that in more specific molecular pathways. So then we can infer with higher confidence about potential targets that we might want to develop drugs and be able to have like a therapeutic effect. Now, in our lab, because we're studying neuropsychiatric disorders and we also study neurodegenerative disorders, we have put lots of effort to further understand about the molecular biology within the human brain. And over the last 10 years, we have been leading and working as part of a very large consortia, some of the consortia you see over here on the screen. And we have the chance to work with many different investigators that we are actually able to put very big sources and resources of human brain tissue and then be able to do joint analysis that we better understand the molecular biology of different molecular markers within human brain specimens that are coming either from individuals that they have no disease or individuals that might have different types of disease. So just to show one example of how we can do some similar analysis to what we do with the GWAS, but in this case now we're more interested to understand how the genetic variation that we can capture with DNA analysis, either through whole genome sequence or through SNP array data, can really tell us something about the molecular markers that we directly can profile from the human brain tissue. And here, for example, we profile the mRNA by doing, let's say, RNA-seq gene expression analysis. This kind of analysis, they're called quantitative trait loci, and what you really try to capture is whether for a specific genetic variation that is proximal to a specific gene, you find an additive effect where one specific allele, in this case is the A allele, compared to the G allele, is associated with higher or lower expression of that specific gene. And here you can see for a very specific gene, the AA compared to the G, you see a gradual increase that gives us that specific information. So having that specific map, it's a good start that we can actually bring back to the GWAS studies and try to understand more about the genetic variation as well as the specific genes within the human brain that might be affected as an effect of this heritability for the trait that we study. Now, of course, when you do this kind of analysis, there's very specific challenges that you also need to consider. And to address some of those challenges, a few years ago, we developed a new statistical approach, which is called multivariate multiple QTL analysis. And the idea behind that was like twofold. One thing is that we have a limited set of brains that we can actually do this kind of molecular analysis. So we would like to find a way that our research is very inclusive and we can include as many donors as possible. And we want to do that to increase the power for the specific analysis. So when you think about inclusivity, we want to have statistical models that we can include individuals coming from different ancestries, meaning European ancestry, African ancestry, Asian ancestry, and so on, and be able to do that with the joint modeling that we don't increase any false positive rate, and at the same time, be able to utilize the joint analysis to help us with increasing the power. At the same time, there's many cases that we might have gene expression or molecular analysis coming from, let's say, different brain region, but from the same donor. So that, from a statistical perspective, it's a repeated measurement, and we want to make sure that when we integrate data coming from the same donor, we do that in a way that we actually address the dependency of the data. And this method that we develop can really address this kind of multi-ancestry and repeated measures analysis by using different modeling with linear mixed models. And by doing that, in this paper, we analyze about 3,000 to 4,000 gene expression profiles from the human brain. And you can see the importance of doing that. So if we start with a single cohort that we integrate over here, we integrate 15 different cohorts. But if you start with one, you can see that for a specific gene, which is this one over here, you have lots of significant genetic variants that you see in red, but none of them stand as being the most kind of highly likelihood to be the functional one. So when we do this kind of credible analysis, we see that we have many significant and pretty much everything is equal contributing to this association. And the number that you see here is up to 96. Now, if we go from one, we go up to 7 brain regions, we already can see that we increase the statistical association. And at the same time, we start getting a more kind of clear winner about which variant seems to be the functional one. If you go from 7 to 13, that becomes even more obvious. And then when you also add data coming from 2 different cohorts, then you can see the p-value reach about 10 to minus 100. And now we can have a very clear effect for a very specific variant that when we do the fine mapping analysis, we can derive a posterior probability that tells us that almost 100% we have a confidence that this specific variant is mediating the expression of that specific gene. Now, we can do exactly the same analysis using different kind of GWAS studies. And here, for example, for this variant affecting this gene, there was exactly the same variant that we found to be associated with a locus in schizophrenia, as well as a joint analysis that was done between schizophrenia and bipolar. And that's a nice example of how we can now go from a GWAS for that specific locus, how we can find a very specific genetic variant, as well as the gene that seems to be mediating that effect. And that, of course, can create opportunities for doing downstream mechanistic analysis, including using some CRISPR technology to do genetic editing in iPS-derived cells. Now, besides gene expression, there's also many other molecular mechanisms that are very important to study in this specific kind of paradigm. And one of the kind of obvious one is to look at the epigenome. And as you know, the DNA, it's extremely long molecule. It's about 6 feet long. And really that kind of very long molecule, you have to find a way that you can actually fit within a tiny nucleus. And the cells are very, very smart. They have a very well organized 3D structure. Actually, the structure is actually 4D because you have the 3D dimensional plus the time component. That this each cell can really organize the DNA in very specific topological organization that really allows the DNA that is critical for that specific cell type to be expressed and be able to produce the specific markers that need for the function of that cell. And as you can see here, this very specific organization, nowadays there's very specific molecular assays using like Hi-C, SIF-seq or ATAC-seq approaches that within each specific cell type, we can actually go and measure that specific epigenome regulation. So we did that in a recent study. As Marianne mentioned, SIGNCODE had a special issue published in Science last week. I think there's a dozen or more papers coming from SIGNCODE that was published in Science. One of the papers is the one I'm presenting here today. And what we actually did here, we actually used about 600 unique brain donors. We actually got brain tissue that we separate into two very broad cell types. One is neurons and the other is non-neurons. And then we apply a very specific technique that we can actually measure the epigenome regulation by looking at the specific epigenetic regions and the specific DNA regions that they're actually what we call they're open. So they're not bound on histone proteins. And they're more likely to be active because different transcription factors they're binding over there. And in this specific work, we generate about 2,000 of those libraries that we actually use to understand better at the population scale how the genetic variation affects not only the gene expression, but the epigenome regulation within the human brain. Now, when you do that and you have combined both gene expression and epigenome regulation, you can start creating a 3D models of the genome where you actually find different regulatory elements like enhancers and promoter affecting very specific genes. And having this specific map, now we can go back to different kind of heritable and traits like schizophrenia and start integrating the GWAS signal that we have from those diseases with those very specific regulatory 3D maps of the genome and try to understand how different risk loci, which specific regulatory sequences there seems to be affected and which specific genes they affect. And here we just saw a few different examples. So if you focus, let's say, in Parkinson's disease, for a very specific locus, we found a very strong association for the gene that is part of the WNT pathway. This is the WNT3. And at the same time, besides the gene, we also found a very strong enhancer that actually regulates that gene. And we confirmed that also with other molecular assays like Hi-C and chromatin conformational capture approaches. And what is very interesting is actually the risk locus and the regulatory element, it's really positioned very far away from the gene. So if you look at the distance, we have about 1 million base pair that the variant and the regulatory sequence is located compared to the gene that regulates. And at the same time, when you look at that effect, you have to skip about 11 genes before you go to that specific kind of gene to link with the GWAS variation. Now, this is something very important to keep in mind because if you remember in the beginning when I showed you the GWAS from the recent suicide analysis, there's always an effort to annotate those genome-wide significant loci with specific genes, but just going with the proximity and the distance, sometimes you might not really capture the real biology of the real gene. So this is why this is very important to bring more data and really try to do this kind of fine mapping analysis. Of course, doing all this analysis, which you know include human brain omics and in silico approaches, are very important, but at the same time, we would like to have also an orthogonal approach to tell us how well we actually do in terms of capturing functional variants for those specific kind of disease traits. And, you know, back in the day, if you go to the wet lab, there was like different approaches that you can get a very specific sequence where you actually have present one allele, let's say the protective allele against, let's say, schizophrenia, versus the risk allele in a different kind of sequence. And then you can overexpress that in specific cells and see if your transcriptional activity, if you're looking at luciferase or other approaches, there's any kind of specific effect that is actually mediated by the differences of those specific allele variants. Now, of course, doing that one at a time is extremely time consuming. So for that reason, we actually nowadays we're using high throughput approaches. And this is part of type of techniques. It's called massively parallel report assay, that you can actually test genetic variant and regulatory sequences, thousands of those within a single experiment. So the way that is working for this analysis, we prioritize about 20,000 different genetic variants that they have disease association and also have or not have very specific effect on the gene expression or the epigenome regulation. And for those specific variants, for each variant, we actually have two different kind of plasmids. One is we have overexpression of one allele, and then we have exactly the same sequence, the same construct, but then we only modify the other variant, which might be the risk versus the protective allele. We actually put that in a specific virus, and we overexpress in iPS-derived neurons. This is NGN2 excitatory neurons. And then we actually would like to quantify the effect in terms of regulatory transcriptional activity of the one allele versus the other allele. And if, let's say, G allele is the one that gives us higher expression or higher epigenome regulation, then when we do this experiment, we should see higher number of reads coming with the G allele versus the A allele. And when you do that genome-wide, out of the 20,000, we identify about 500 of those variants that will have very strong allelic effect. And this is very important to have in those kind of functional exploration. And I'm just going to show you one example here. So looking over here, this is a GWAS coming from the major depression. And again, you can see here a very specific locus that we have the same problem I was discussing with you earlier, meaning that we have about 50 to 100 genetic variants. Everything is being associated with the same level of statistical threshold. And then it's again very difficult to associate the gene of the specific variants. Now, when we go in the same locus, we see that for the expression and the epigenome, we also have a very strong genetic signal for this specific gene, as well as a specific regulatory element over here. When you do your joint fine mapping analysis with the GWAS, you end up getting a single variant, which is illustrated here, that tells you that most likely this is a genetic variant mediating both the disease risk, change in the expression, and change in the epigenome regulation. We can now test also the transcriptional activity of that variant based on this functional assay. And this is what we're getting over here. We get a complete picture where the G allele, which is the risk allele, compared to the T allele, is going to increase the risk for the MDD, for the GWAS. It's going to increase the expression for that specific gene. It's going to increase the epigenome regulation of the enhancer that is positioned within this specific gene. And it's also going to be validated within the functional assay that we did MPRA for higher transcriptional activity. And now that becomes a very strong candidate that if there's interest, you can actually take it to the next level and start doing more specific mechanistic studies. Now, overall, I was happily surprised and really very excited to see that when we do this high throughput functional assays, and we have done many more analyses that I'm not showing here, so it really matters that you do that in a way that you incorporate human brain omics data and you use this kind of in silico pipeline. Because based on this analysis, we can see that variants coming from the GWAS that we can actually prioritize based on molecular markers we have from the human brain, either from the gene expression or the epigenome regulation, that really help us to further develop the fine mapping. And then that dramatically, significantly increase the chance that those variants that we prioritize through this pipeline are going to be functionally validated using this kind of MPRA, which again, give us a very specific platform or specific approach that now we have high throughput methods that from a GWAS variation, we can go all the way down to some molecular function that we can actually proceed to the next step with experimental validation. Now, of course, when you do all this analysis, we also need to think about the complexity that we have in the human brain. And as you know, if you look in the cortex, you have six layers, there's multiple different cell types, there's much more heterogeneity between the different cell types and the molecular markers. And everything I told you so far, it only consider doing molecular analysis either at the bulk tissue level or even the epigenome regulation that we're discussing, We're still doing very separation of broad cell types, meaning neurons and non-neurons, but we're still looking kind of a cell type or bulk tissue analysis. However, we don't really consider the heterogeneity we have in those markers and the complexity of the human brain tissue. And this is a missed opportunity because if you think that we have the tissue and the different cell types, and each cell type you can see here as a different type of fruit, and here we have a basket of fruits. With the bulk tissue analysis, what we do is we pretty much create a smoothie. And this is very difficult to use for doing this very high resolution analysis that we want to prioritize. What is the ideal scenario is that for each fruit, we can do molecular analysis that we can capture markers coming from very specific cell types. And as you can see here, we know exactly in this glass how many pineapples, how many strawberries, and what other type of fruits we have. Going one step further, we would like to do that in a way that we actually capture the molecular markers in situ, so we can actually cut the tissue and be able to do high throughput molecular profiling within those markers, and at the same time have a better understanding about the site architecture, as well as the topological organization and the relationship of the different cells coming from the human brain tissue. And this is the paradigm of the spatial single cell analysis. So, of course, single cell analysis is something that has started over the last few years, and there really has been multiple ongoing efforts to do that even in the human brain. We started about 5 years ago. This is part of a big consortium we are leading. It's a PsyKED consortium, and myself and also Harry Haratunian, who is also a professor at Sinai, and he's also a Marek investigator, as well as other investigators within Wisconsin, Gladstone, Russ, and other individuals. We actually have put together this consortium that we really try to bring resources from multiple donors that they have human brain tissue, as well as also have genetic information, different clinical diagnoses, and many other phenotypic data. So the result was to create what we call the PsyKED cohort. This includes about 1,500 unique brain donors. You can see here the different demographics. Pretty much we have a really nice split ratio between males and females across the whole cohort. About one third of the cohort, they are diverse, meaning they don't have the European white ancestry, and that really help us look in other population and do more ancestry specific analysis. And then this is a very nice cohort with many phenotypic data and different kind of clinical diagnosis, as well as neuropathology. And you can see here that we capture a very large number of cases, each one coming from different diseases, including neurodegenerative and serious mental illness. Now, having those human brain tissue, everything was came to the Center for Disease Neurogenomics, and we process in a randomized scheme, we actually process all the tissue to create a single cell atlas. So the way we do that is we get tissue from each donor and we do the single cell profiling. And after many years of work and many people involved, this is pretty much the outcome that we get. So here we have done single cell profiling coming from the prefrontal cortex of 1,500 unique brain donors. That include about 3,000 single cell libraries. And overall, we have done genome-wide gene expression analysis within about 6.3 million single cell profiles. Now, when you actually aggregate all those cells, and we actually use the markers expressed from each of the single cell profile, we can now annotate and create a cell taxonomy. So now we let the molecular markers within each cell to organize themselves, and then we actually try to do annotation of the different cell types. And as you can see here, we have very broad different cell types like oligodendrocytes, we have different excitatory neurons, we have astrocytes, and so on. And then in terms of the taxonomy, we actually do that in a hierarchical stepwise approach. First, we define the broad classes of the different cell types, like excitatory neurons, inhibitory neurons, and then we go step forward to further classify the different subclasses and the subtypes. And as an outcome, from this taxonomy, we have identified 8 classes of cells that include 27 subclasses that we can further stratify into 65 different subtypes. Because of the scale of the data, for example, here we have the different excitatory neurons. Now we can zoom in and just take a look over here. And you can see that within excitatory neurons, we have also an organization whether that neuron is coming from very specific layers of the cortex. So this is layer 2 or 3 excitatory neurons versus layer 3-5 over here. Now, it's very important that those single cell approaches, we also validate the site architecture and the laminar organization of those cells. So for that reason, for a subset of those brains, we can also cut sections of the tissue, and we can actually do high throughput spatial analysis where we're actually looking hundreds of different markers. But at the same time, we can actually do that when we actually leave the cell and we study that in situ. And in this example, this is an actual image from one of those brain sections. So over here, it's the upper layer. Here is the deep layer. This is the gray matter, and over here you have the white matter. That's why you see absence of excitatory neurons. And each little dot, it's a single cell because this is a very high resolution spatial analysis. And as you can see here, you have a really nice organization. So layer 2, 3 neurons, that's up over here. And then as you go further down, you go more to layer 3, 4, 5, 6. And this is a very nice validation for the taxonomy and the spatial organization that we have from those specific individuals. Now, to my knowledge, this is by far the largest effort looking at single cell analysis within a project in terms of the number of individuals. So other published work, I think up to now, has done about 400 brains, but really bringing together resources for 1,500 unique brain donors, this is really a tremendous resource that we can actually use and really be able to do lots of interesting Down syndrome analysis. So some of the Down syndrome analysis that we try to do is we try to do integration with the different kind of genome-wide significant loci. And here we're using a slightly different approach. This is part of what we call the transcriptome-wide association studies. And the idea behind that is we have a very specific molecular trait, which is the gene expression within a specific cell type. So now we try to understand and capture the variation of those molecular markers that is actually being explained by the genetic variation, while at the same time we correct or we ignore variation coming, let's say, from other factors like technical variation, disease effect, and so on. And the way it's working is like in the PsychAD, we have for each individual genotypes. So here you see the different individuals, and we have done genotyping, let's say, for 10 million different genetic variants. And at the same time, we have genome-wide expression for all those specific cell types that I show you. And now we can train and use AI to train different models that we can predict the gene expression within each specific cell type just by using the genetic variation. Now, having that information from the PsychAD, we can now go back to GWAS data and now do imputation and go from the GWAS where you have the statistical association for the different genetic variants. We can now create now new association maps, but instead of looking genetic variation, we can use the imputation from here to tell us about the level of association for specific genes within specific cell types for a given trait. So how does it look this? This is one example. So here, by running in the PsychAD, we have done this imputation approach, and we pretty much have very good models that we can capture pretty much the whole pretty much every gene that is found in the genome. So here we have about 24,000 unique genes that we can impute in any of those cell types within the PsychAD cohort. When you look at the combination between the genes by the cell type, because again, this is single cell analysis, so we have multiple different cell types that we're testing this association, we can actually capture robustly more than 250,000 gene by cell combinations. And as you can see here, for different cell types, let's say excitatory neurons, we can capture about 30,000 unique genes. And there's differences in terms of the power and the capture that we have for different cell types. Now, having those models, we can go to the GWAS. And this is one example of how the data look like. And let's say for Alzheimer's disease, by integrating that with the existing GWAS, we can robustly identify 133 genes, unique genes, that they are statistically associated with AD versus controls. And this is after you apply Bonferroni, which is very strict correction at the 0.05 threshold. And to show you how this looks, this is the GWAS Manhattan plot for the Alzheimer. So by doing all this analysis, we can actually transform this Manhattan GWAS plot to those very specific TWAS plot. So the difference here is that, first of all, you have way fewer dots because here there's 10 million genetic variants, while here we're testing a few thousand genes. And the difference here is that with this analysis, we don't only say a statistical association with a given genetic variant, but we can pinpoint on three different things. First thing is we can identify and detect very specific gene, and that becomes a great substrate for mechanistic studies. Second is because we have single cell, we can actually pinpoint to exactly the specific cell type and specific gene that seems to be mediated the heritability for that specific locus. And the third thing is also we can also pinpoint whether the directionality of the association it's actually upregulated or downregulated gene. And that's something very important because if you have a very good target within a specific cell type, you want to know if you need to create an agonist or antagonist in order to have the optimal therapeutic effect for the specific target. And with this analysis, we can actually get that very nice and very robustly. And our top target is BIN1 gene within microglia, which is upregulated. And again, this is something that our group using other data and many other groups, they have robustly identified throughout the years. So this is a nice validation to see that we capture the same kind of markers. Now, because we have those imputation models and we can pretty much transfer those imputation models to any data that we actually only have genetic information. So meaning that for individuals that we have genotypes, we don't need to have any other kind of omics data to be able to make this kind of imputation. And that's something important because as part of the Million Veteran Program, over the years, we have been participating as part of the MVP-006, and now we have the MVP-076 program. And what we actually can do, we can get all this single cell high throughput analysis and all these imputation models and bring those imputation models within the MVP and use 650,000 veterans that we have their genotypes. And we also have so much clinical data, be able to do that imputation and now have those specific individuals that we can actually look for analysis for specific gene within a specific cell type and start looking different traits. And so that was kind of also the focus of the pilot study and the award actually we got from the SPRINT. So the idea was to actually use many of the human brain omics data that we are generating and utilizing within the MVP and see if we can use some of those imputation models within the MVP to find any interesting association for specific cell type or specific genes that they might be associated with suicidal behavior. And as an outcome, we have already been doing some analysis on that front. And one thing is, you know, when you look in VA data and there's many groups that they have been doing that for many years and there's lots of interesting development. One important thing to consider is what exactly phenotype you're using. And we actually spent some time here to thinking about the phenotype. And this is one way that we decide to do the analysis. Of course, we have tested many other approaches and there's many more stuff to be done. But that, at least that's one of the initial steps that we have put together. So VA has a very rich information coming from the SPAN, which is the VA Suicide Prevention Application Network. And also we can all utilize data from the National Death Index, and we can actually combine that with all the other electronic health record data that exists within the MVP and the VA. And we decide to actually use kind of to create an ordinal variable that tells us about the severity of the suicidal behavior. So the way we do that is we primarily look in individuals with European ancestry. We start with that because we have, this is the population that we have the maximum power based on the MVP as well as the PsyGD cohort. And as you can see here, by doing this kind of stepwise approach, we have about 400,000 individuals that we gave a value of zero. And these are individuals without having any suicidal behavior. And then we have 1, 2, 3, 4 that we actually gave labels to individuals based on the severity of the suicide behavior. So one was self-injury without clear suicidal intent. Then we have suicidal intent and that require outpatient care. The same thing with inpatient care. And then was the most severe outcome, which is death by suicide. Now, keep in mind, this is an ordinal variable that we use, and in our model, we can actually use some very kind of elegant ordinal regression models to really be able to use the full spectrum of this suicidal severity and find molecular markers. Now, our model allows different effect size when you go from 0 to 1 versus 1 to 2. So this is not just a simple linear model. This is like looking the ordinal expression and at the same time allow for variation within the different kind of groups that we have for the each phenotype. All right, so using the MVP, we have run this model, and the good news is that we have found about 163 significant genes. These are genes that after you do the PsyK8 imputation, they survive even the very strict Bonferroni p-value of 0.05. And the other outcome we see from this analysis is that about half of those associations, meaning 45%, we see that those genes are primarily found within excitatory and inhibitory neurons. There's also significant contribution of other cell types, including the oligos and the astrocytes, but at least neurons seems to be covering the majority. Those two cell types seems to be covering the majority of the signal. By looking at different pathways, we can now identify very specific target of how those 163 genes seems to be organized. And not surprisingly, given that we see lots of signal coming from excitatory and inhibitory neurons, here we see many different biological processes that they have to do with postsynaptic transmission, and very specifically, they have to do with transmitter-gated ion channel. This is something exciting because having very specific target in this specific kind of pathways, that really can open up, you know, more kind of translational opportunities, because those gated ion channel is something that, at least from a therapeutic perspective and small molecule development, is something that can be targeting and developed further. And just to show you some of the early results, this is kind of one of the TWAS plot that we have. Again, this here we use an ordinal regression to study the association of cell types for specific genes with the severity of the suicidal behavior. And here we can find many, many genes. I'm just going to pinpoint maybe one, but there's many other interesting stuff. And I'm going to start with this HCRTR1, which really got lots of interest from our group. And this is something we further explore right now. But this is actually the gene that is encoding for the receptor type 1 of the orexin. And as you might know, orexin is a neuropeptide. It has been heavily involved and modulate behavior like depression, mood, reward, and appetite and feeding behavior. So it's a very good candidate for depressive behavior as well as depressive and aggression behavior. And indeed, many previous studies, either doing human genetics or using like animal models, they have confirmed that this specific gene and transcript, it's very important for those feeding behavior and aggression behavior. Yeah, so that's one of the targets. And this is just a simple example of how, you know, just by using MVP and using this kind of large-scale single-cell data, we now have a very specific target and the directionality that we can actually start thinking more about how we can proceed with different kind of validation mechanistic exploration. Now, one thing that I mentioned in the beginning is that we came up with this very specific ordinal phenotype for suicidal behavior, which is, I think it's a good start, but there's many more stuff to be done there. And I'm just going to show one example from a recent study that we published for something very, very different. And this has to do with one of the eating disorders. It's called binge eating disorder. And as you might know, this is extremely prevalent, affect about 2 to 3% of the population. But in terms of ICD coding, that was a diagnosis that was introduced in the ICD later, I think in 2015. So that means that when you go to biobank data and EHR data like MVP, you're going to have many, many individuals that they might have that specific disease, but this is not recording within the EHR. And this is something that we also saw in the MVP, because based on the prevalence of that specific phenotype, when we were just looking ICD codes within the MVP, we really underestimate the individuals that they might have this specific diagnosis. But at the same time, the good things about MVP and other biobank is that you have so many other clinical features. You have data about them, the lifestyle, blood work, and many medications that you can actually use potentially and apply AI approaches that potentially you can use the rest of the phenome to really give you a prediction about the phenotype that you have interest. And this is something that David did in this work. So he actually trained different kind of machine learning approaches to use the very highly enriched phenome from the MVP and be able to impute that specific phenotype, even in individuals that they never got the bad diagnosis. And then we actually now, we saw in this paper that we can use this kind of machine learning derived phenotype to improve the power of the GWAS. And we actually make some kind of nice biological insight within that phenotype. I have to say that before this study, there was not any genetic study within this bad eating disorder phenotype. So we really went from a study that there was nothing known about the heritability or at least the genetic variation to some very concrete biology. And what we found here is that by doing this kind of genetic analysis and using some Mendelian randomization approaches, we found that there's some kind of interesting etiologic relationship between iron overload and this kind of eating behavior, which is not surprising because you know that metabolism of iron, especially in kids, there's the famous Pica syndrome and many other syndromes have been associated with this kind of peculiar eating behavior. But here we found, at least within the binge eating disorder, there's a nice relationship in terms of the metabolism of iron. And there has been some ongoing work, primarily in mouse model, done by Georgios Volodakis' lab, that they actually now can replicate and find very interesting association in terms of the iron and the eating behavior, even when you start looking at mice. But this is just one example I would like to mention here, is that we had the phenotype that we have very little capture within the MVP, but using AI and really borrowing information from all the other phenomics data we have within the MVP, we were able to capture something that, at least from a biological perspective, it makes sense and might be providing some very helpful insights. So that's something, of course, there's a lot of space to apply similar approaches, even within the suicide. And of course, there's many investigators, either through SPRINT or other kind of approaches, or even within MVP, that they have lots of expertise of applying those models. And of course, we are very happy to work with anyone and everyone to make sure that we apply team science and we can really do that in the best possible way. All right, I'm reaching the top of the hour, so I would like to make sure I leave some time for questions. So what I told you today is that we can use different molecular markers coming from the human brain. I show you some data from gene expression and epigenome regulation, and we can actually use that for in silico prioritization and better understand the heritability of different complex traits. At least from the suicide, we see that by doing this TWAS and using an expanded single cell data, we see some very interesting signal primarily affecting neuronal and synaptic genes. And there's also a few different targets that we can now prioritize for additional mechanistic studies. And hopefully looking in the future, I think, you know, with the extended and expanded biobank data, the really robust single cell data and statistical methods, as well as using some more elegant and elaborate AI methods to better dissect and capture the suicidal behavior within the phenomics data. There's a very unique opportunity here to really start looking initially in the MVP, but of course, all these imputational models that we build in the human brain, those can be transferred to any individual and any clinical data, assuming that those individuals, they have some kind of genome-wide genetic profiling, like SNP array, whole genome sequence, and so on. And it's going to be very interesting to see, even in ongoing clinical studies, how those imputed models that we capture in the human brain, how they might be associated with more kind of deep phenotyping for suicide or with imaging or many other kind of approaches that many of you might be already doing. Again, there have been many, many people participating here, both from the Center for Disease Neurogenomics at Sinai and the Center for Precision Medicine and Translational Therapeutics within the Bronx PA. There's also lots of integration and collaboration within the Bronx PA MAREC. And these are many of the individuals participating. So I would like to thank everyone for this effort. And I would also like to thank the organizers for the invitation and thank everyone for staying here and listening to my talk. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. We do have just a few pending questions out here for the audience. If you have a question, please use that Q&A screen to submit those questions into us. The first question here, Thank you so much for including data about the increase in deaths by suicide in women veterans since 2001. Does this data include transgender women veterans as well as transgender veterans who identify as male? And how will this data be used to help all women veterans, including transgender veterans?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And the data I was saying about in my introduction, the background, this is coming from previous publications. And I think that's a very significant problem that we need to be aware and really try to address. For the analysis that I was showing today about from the MVP, up to now, we have actually used sex as a covariate in the analysis, but we haven't really looked very specifically for specific effect, either male, female, or even look also transgender. This is something that we're going to be very interesting to apply. And one problem within the MVP is that for the analysis we are doing, we need to have very large population. And because it's a matter of having enough statistical power. And as you know, within the MVP, the majority of the individuals, I think 90 or 91% are males. So we know already that when we start looking for association within females, that power is gonna be very compromised. Now, in terms of the transgender veterans, I need to go back within the MVP and see how well we can actually capture that information within the MVP and how many individuals we can really detect, because again, that's something here we have to consider two different challenges. One is, do we have the right phenotypic information to identify those individuals? If we do, the second challenge we have to address and think is, do we have enough individuals to start looking for, to have enough power for doing the analysis? Now, one thing that is very exciting is because those imputation models that we brought within the MVP, we can actually do imputation at the individual level. So that means that for all these 650,000 veterans that we have within the MVP, we have done a separate imputation that we capture the gene expression across thousands of genes and across dozens of different cells. So here, even if we have a very small of group of individuals that we have very concrete hypotheses, and we have really robustly identified, like looking suicidal behavior within transgender veterans, we actually have an opportunity here to start looking some of the signal. So I think that's a very interesting question. It's very, very challenging, but at the same time, it's very, very important. So that's definitely something we're going to be very interesting to explore in the future.
Great, thank you. The next question here, among the GWAS genome-specific variants and epigenetics, was there a common marker irrespective of the pan-genetic heritage?
I'm trying to understand a little bit this question. So my understanding is, because here we do integration of the different human brain omics data, but we rely on the GWAS signal that we're actually getting from different traits. So if I understand correctly, the question is, can we identify specific molecular markers that they actually give us information for multiple different traits or giving information across different ancestries? I have a little bit difficulty to understand the question, so I'm going to try to address it in the best possible way. So at least from the GWAS studies, because each GWAS study is looking for a very specific case control design, we can actually infer and come up with very specific molecular markers that we define for this specific GWAS trait. But now, as you know, many of those heritable and complex serious mental illnesses like bipolar and schizophrenia, there's very significant co-heritability. So even when you do at the GWAS level, you can see very close relationship between the genetic signal and genetic architecture you have, let's say, for schizophrenia against, let's say, with bipolar disorder. So even if we do our analysis, the GWAS brain omics imputation analysis separately in those disorders, we have seen that we can capture many of those markers that we have some kind of convergence between different traits. And actually right now we're working on some kind of new analysis that we try to bring all this data and really try to do that from a perspective that we're looking for shared heritability between different traits. And the idea here is that, can we identify a small set of variant, a small set of genes, and a small set of cell types that seems to be mediating lots of the risk architecture, not only for schizophrenia, but for another 5-10 disorders. And I think that's something important because A, I think we're gonna find some markers and we already see some early results. B, when you have that, you can really start thinking about a very small subset of your genes and the proteins that hopefully by targeting and creating medications, that can be something that you can actually apply not only within one disorder, but across many, many disorders. So hopefully I gave the answer, I addressed your question, but if not, please let me know or please reach out to me through email. Should I read the second question? I can see now in the chat.
Yeah, if you can see the second question there, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. Secondly, from your study, was there a correlation for an association between GWAS and epigenetic markers that translate to a specific protein that can largely be designated as potential diagnostic marker for suicide? Yes, so we already have identified many different genes and we see that many of those, and we have done some analysis using also protein information, and we can identify some association going from GWAS to the protein level. There's two considerations here, right? So one thing is when you look at the protein, we primarily study the human brain. So the question is how many of those markers that you find in the human brain, you can actually detect in the periphery that you can use as a biomarker. And there is some interesting work that we're actually doing. We don't look that much in protein, but we're very interested in genes. And as you know, there is there's different kind of cargos with cell-free DNA, cell-free RNA. There's like extravascular and extravesicular, extracellular vesicles that they actually be released by cell types in the brain that can actually circulate in the periphery. And there's a way that we can capture many molecular markers in the blood that we believe they originate from the brain. So that's something interesting that we are actually looking at this potential for development over there. One thing to keep in mind is that because of the small effect size of those genetic studies, even when we do those molecular analysis and all this kind of imputation integrative analysis, really the changes that we find even within the protein or the molecular markers, it's extremely small. And that goes back to the comment I was making about the small effect size and the polygenic architecture, that even if we detect those markers, I'm not sure if it's gonna be enough, the expected effect sizes, to really tell us which one's gonna be case versus control. I think here we need to apply a second approach on top of these kind of genetic driven approaches, where now we can actually directly associate and study molecular markers that we see either in the human brain of individuals that they die of suicide versus not. And that really can also give us stronger effect sizes and study the disease effect, as well as many of the studies that many people that might be doing by looking like peripheral biomarkers in those individuals. So for the human brain suicide, there has been some efforts, really nothing really organized in a very big effort that you look like hundreds of thousands of brains with suicide versus not. But there's some kind of ongoing effort and some kind of initial ideas, and I suggest everyone to take a look. There was a recent commentary or perspective we just published a few days ago, talking about how we can use human brain omics within suicide, and we actually provide some ideas of how we can use existing human brain resources, really try to do that in a more kind of organized manner. And I think that paper came out Biological Psychiatry a few days ago, and I'm happy to stay around if there's questions.
I have not seen any other questions come in. I think that is where we are at right now. So, and we're just past the top of the hour, so probably we can close out at this point. Let's check to see if you have any closing remarks you would like to make, or Dr. Dobsha, if you have anything you would like to.
I just want to say thanks so much for joining. This is a tremendous amount of new information for me, for sure. And I think I'll be reaching out to talk with you a little bit more, if that's okay. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much for the invitation again.
Thank you so much. For the audience, when I close the meeting out, you will be prompted with a feedback form. We would appreciate if you took a few moments to fill that out. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for today's HSR Cyber Seminar, and we look forward to seeing you at a future session. Have a great afternoon, everyone.